Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 6th of April, the day after the primary, as promised. The Wisconsin primary results this hour. A large turnout in our state yesterday, as Craig Gilbert writes today in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, of the more than 30 states that have voted in presidential primaries and caucuses this year, only one, and that was New Hampshire, turned out a higher rate. 47% of the voting age population, 49% of all eligible voting age citizens went to the polls. On the Republican side, 1,098,758 voted in the race for the presidency. On the Democratic side, the number was 1,002,468, so more Republicans voting than Democrats. Here were the numbers, or the percentage points. On the Republican side, 48.24% for Ted Cruz, 35.08% for Donald Trump, and 14.10% for John Kasich. On the Democratic side, it looks as though Bernie Sanders won almost all the counties. I think that's the way I'm reading the map here, except for Milwaukee County, and he didn't lose that by much. He had 56.57% of the vote to Hillary Clinton's 43.11%. We have three guests with us this hour. Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, considered one of the nation's best political reporters. He has been prominently featured on national TV and radio this past week, and he doesn't have to comb his hair for us because he can just take his shoes off and relax for a while. He's not been relaxing much. Tim Murphy joining us later in the hour, senior reporter at Mother Jones DC Bureau, and David Marcosco will join us, U.S. political editor for the DailyMail.com. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. I think we'll have many because we've been doing politics for a long time on this show. It was a big day yesterday, and I'm sure many of you will want to respond to what happened here. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Craig Gilbert, you're still awake.
I think so. Let me know if I stop making sense.
No, you're going to make a lot of sense. You can have a long sleep and you can make it up over the weekend, maybe, for all the sleep you've lost. I understand you can do that, and it's okay. Well, let's look at this. Why we turned out in such huge numbers here, only second to New Hampshire. Why such big turnout? I mean, it's great, but why?
Well, I think there's, like, when something unusual happens, you can find all sorts of reasons. So we had a race that lingered for a long time and that is not getting less exciting. In some ways, it's getting more exciting. That's unusual to have a contest so late in the calendar where it's still getting so much attention. Wisconsin was a standalone primary, so you had this sort of concentration of resources, of candidates, of media, of interest, all in one state for more than a week. You've got a state that has, you know, relatively easy to vote in, open primaries, election day registration. You've got a tradition of high turnouts in Wisconsin, and you have the sort of concurrent elections, state, local, and federal. So I don't know which ones are the most important. Usually it's the competitiveness of the elections that drive it, but there's also big state-to-state differences in terms of the voting rules and the voting culture that helps explain why you can have Wisconsin and New Hampshire up at 50%, roughly speaking, and then another state at 10 or 15 or 20.
Let's look at the Republican side, because so much has been made in your article front page today. You talk about Donald Trump's loss here, increasing the odds of a history-making open convention. That was one of the themes of this particular election. Does it become inevitable now that it is an open convention, do you think, Craig?
I don't think it's inevitable. I mean, he could, but it's certainly a very good possibility. I mean, he could bounce back in New York. You know, we've seen candidates win in one state that's good for them and think they're carrying a lot of momentum into the next state, and suddenly they're fighting on not so friendly turf and something very different happens. So New York is a way better state for him than Wisconsin. So that, you know, it'll be a different story there. But just the sheer math of only getting 6 delegates out of Wisconsin out of the 42 in Wisconsin, that just makes it you know, harder for him to get to 1237. And so it's mathematically harder to do that. He has to win a higher percentage of the remaining delegates to do that. So it does increase the odds of an open convention. I think it's kind of in the balance right now.
Hmm. As we well know, there was a very large Stop Trump movement, Republican establishment figures, the governor, a lot of conservative talk radio uniting behind Ted Cruz. Is that just the beginning of an effort that we'll see in other states, a Stop Trump movement?
Yes, but it's going to differ from state to state, because in Wisconsin you had two things coming together. You had the national Stop Trump movement, which saw this golden opportunity and a kind of a desperate opportunity too, because it's getting late in the game, and they realized and they figured out that Wisconsin was a place where Trump was vulnerable, and so they needed to stop him, and they did. But it also dovetailed with some things that were going on the ground in Wisconsin. You had a governor who was kind of anti-Trump, who'd been in the race against Trump. You've got, you mentioned talk radio, that unusual for talk radio around the country, kind of a wall of opposition to Trump in the talk radio scene. And you've got an electorate, a Republican electorate, that even before Trump's kind of stormy arrival into the state and before the governor's endorsement, for many months had been cool to Trump. And the most Trump-resistant part of that Republican electorate was in southeastern Wisconsin, maybe partly due to talk radio, but I think also really due to the demographics of that part of the state and the conservatism of that electorate and kind of also the partisanship of that electorate, with a history of kind of getting behind the sort of party candidate, not the kind of outsider anti-establishment candidate like Trump. A lot of things came together in southeastern Wisconsin, and if you look at the history of Republican primaries in the state, the maps kind of look the same. They kind of look like the candidate that wins, you know, the southeastern corner of Wisconsin, no matter how many counties they lose in the rest of the state, ends up winning a Republican primary.
Hmm. Let's go to the Democratic side, where Bernie had better than expected. Most polls were showing a victory, but 2 points, 4 points, 5 points, it's 13.46%, which is pretty large. From my reading in the map, of the map in the Journal Sentinel this morning, it appears to me that he won every county but Milwaukee. Is that right, Craig?
I have to look at the map again. I've got that. I can tell you in a minute, but last time I looked, there were like four counties. I think Marinette was one, and there were a couple in the west. I don't know whether they flipped or not, but there were. Milwaukee County was the only county of any size, and he didn't lose it by a lot. And right. He didn't even lose the city of Milwaukee by a lot. So a really broad, geographically broad, demographically broad victory.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? What does it mean for Bernie Sanders? Why was it such a big win for him in this state? What does it mean for Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton? And do you think that this is, so many people are saying it's an underreported story, his success, and that Wisconsin wasn't written about a whole lot after this kind of victory. Is it just a foregone conclusion that Hillary Clinton is the nominee?
I think it's two things. I mean, the Republican race has been sapping a lot of the attention just because of Donald Trump and because of the craziness and the, you know, there is more uncertainty surrounding the Republican race. The divisions in the party appear to be deeper. And when you talk to Republican voters or ask Republican voters how they feel about the other Republican candidate they're not supporting, they're much more likely to be very negative than a Democratic voter who doesn't support Hillary Clinton or a Democratic voter who doesn't support Bernie Sanders. So I think that Republican race has been more attention getting, and also the math is better for Hillary Clinton than it mm-hmm. is for Donald Trump, the two front runners. So she wasn't seen as having as much to lose in Wisconsin as Donald Trump was. I mean, there's no Stop Clinton movement in the party. The party establishment is pretty comfortable with Hillary Clinton. The math is still difficult for Bernie Sanders, and he's partly a victim of the Democratic rules, which make it difficult to win big chunks of delegates, which he has to do in coming from behind. I mean, if you just take Wisconsin as an example, you know, almost anything he did, he wasn't gonna net more than 10 delegates out of Wisconsin. There were 86. Pledge delegates in play, and the way the system works, when you're divvying up small chunks of delegates at the district level, you have to win by overwhelming margins to do better than a 50% cut of those delegates. And so he got, you know, in many of the districts that he won, he only got half the delegates. That's just the math.
Right.
And so that's working against him. But he, and also I think, you know, the Clinton campaign worked very hard to lower, to sort of set their expectations and lower their expectations in Wisconsin, because they did think they were going to lose here. They didn't want it to be a big loss, and I think they were hoping for a smaller margin than what we got. But it was seen as a good state for Bernie Sanders, but that shouldn't take away from the size of his victory. I mean, it is a significant victory, and it does, you know, allow him to keep credibly challenging her, and instead of having to sit around answering questions about why are you still in the race.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. I found myself, you know, with radios going and iPads and phones and television to all these channels last night. I love election nights. But I found Chuck Todd's comment kind of interesting at some point during the night last night, that Hillary Clinton will be the last non-progressive Democratic presidential candidate, looking at the huge numbers that Bernie is getting among young voters and the number of people, I think he was pointing to Wisconsin, who identify themselves as liberal in the Democratic Party. Would you agree with his assessment?
You could be right. I mean, certainly it was true that the it was a more liberal electorate. In fact, you know, it struck me. I went back and looking at the 2004 Democratic primary, presidential primary in Wisconsin, which was won by John Kerry over two people to his left, John Edwards and Howard Dean, or four people to his left, because it included Dennis Kucinich and Al Sharpton. Only 13% of the voters in that primary identified themselves as very liberal. So that's a Democratic primary. You've got 13% of the voters in a Democratic primary identifying themselves as very liberal. And only 40%, around 40%, called themselves liberal. So the majority of voters did not consider themselves liberals in a Democratic primary. So very different this year. You knew that number was going to go up because that's been the trend nationally. About twice as many, about a quarter of the voters called themselves very liberal, and about two-thirds of the voters called themselves liberal. So a different electorate. In fact, you had kind of a both parties moving in opposite directions, because the Republican
Yes.
Party was more conservative electorate than it had been in the past, and that's part of a national trend. It may also be part of sort of what everything that Wisconsin's gone through in the last 6 years, polarizing people. But I think there is something to what he said. I mean, looking ahead, and it's not just the electorate. I mean, it's also the way campaign finances change. I mean, Bernie Sanders has showed, just as Barack Obama showed, but particularly Bernie Sanders has shown that you can start out as a dark horse, and you can, you know, if you tap into that part of the Democratic constituency, you can just keep raising tons and tons of money from small donors. It's almost inexhaustible.
Mm-hmm. And one note on the state Supreme Court race before we go to the many phone calls that people who are already on hold here, the Kloppenburg-Bradley. From our crunching of the numbers, Scotty and I were crunching some this morning, it would appear to us that there were 76,632 Democratic voters who either did not vote in that race or voted for Rebecca Bradley.
And what was it, was there a number on the opposite side of that? Were there Republican primary voters that did not vote or voted for Kloppenburg?
Yeah, we were looking at Democratic particularly.
Okay.
I don't know about the Republican side, but that's a lot of Democrats who you would expect who would have been Kloppenburg voters who didn't vote for her.
Yeah, and there's always going to be some fall off, because it's just some people, you know, the presidential race is what drives people to the polls, and so some people are going to vote in that and not vote in the other races. You know, it'll be interesting to see when the dust settles, you know, kind of what the takeaways are
mm-hmm.
from that race. I didn't follow it nearly as closely as the presidential.
Right.
But it was the first time in 16 years you had the Supreme Court race going on at the same time as a presidential race, so we don't have a lot of history to go on in terms of how these races played on each other. But certainly, you know, Bradley was certainly helped, obviously, by the nature of the Republican primary and the way it drew voters to the polls. There was a gap in the Republican and Democratic vote it wasn't as big as in a lot of other states. It was only about 10% bigger on the Republican side than on the Democratic side, but I think that clearly was helpful to
Interesting.
Bradley.
All right, let's go to phone calls. Craig Gilbert is our first guest as we break down what happened yesterday, which, you know, let's pat ourselves on the back. It's great that we are involved here in the state of Wisconsin. It's when you look at, as Craig writes, 30 states that have already voted in primaries and caucuses, only one turned out at a higher rate. That was New Hampshire than the state of Wisconsin yesterday. We went to the polls in large numbers. That's a good thing. All right, here's our phone number and other ways to reach us because our phone lines are jammed. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Craig Gilbert is our first guest. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Craig Gilbert is here now. Let's go to phone calls. Tim in Eau Claire, our first caller. Craig, hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi.
I guess I was a little shocked by the numbers in Eau Claire County. Yes, Bernie had a rather large number of people who voted for him over Hillary. I think it was 3,000 or 3,500 people more in a county with about 100,000 people in it. That surprised me, but at the same time, based on how huge his crowds were versus Hillary's crowd, specifically in Eau Claire, I kind of expected it to be a little bit bigger. I expected maybe the state to go, you know, 60-40 as opposed to, you know, high 50s, low 40s.
Well, it looks to me, according to my information, like Eau Claire was his third best county in the state. Along with La Crosse, so he won them both about 64% to 28%. So that's pretty overwhelming. I think, you know, a 13 or 13.5 point victory margin is pretty impressive. And just to get back to you on how many counties Hillary Clinton won, the answer is three.
Three.
She won Buffalo, Polk, and Milwaukee.
Okay.
So that was it, which is pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Tim, thanks very much. Another Bernie caller, Carl in Madison. Hi.
Yes, hello. This is just such a remarkable political season. I'm a 52-year-old and was standing on the floor of the Kohl Center listening to Bernie Sanders tell it like it is with a bunch of much younger people around me. And as I looked around, I kind of felt kind of old. And then I looked up the podium and I felt kind of young. And it feels to me that there are just a number of people who, for the first time maybe in their voting lives, don't have to swallow hard and stomach their hopes and dreams for America in order to really just listen to someone who has a career-long history of supporting the common good. And I think that's why the numbers were so high. And in the press, they keep discounting him. They called him a fringe candidate to begin with, and then they moved on to, well, he can't catch her, but he'll move Hillary to the left. And now I think we're seeing America waking up to the possible, not just the hopes and dreams that are pie in the sky, but where we need to go in America with this last best chance, as many of us feel, to get it right.
Mm, thank you, young Carl. You are young compared to him. It is, when you think about it, a pretty amazing story, Craig, to have a 74, 75-year-old Democratic socialist doing as well as he is in this country. I mean, really?
Yeah, and it's also just some of the voting patterns are pretty remarkable. I mean, just the age gap is just, and it's, you know, rightly so, his support among young voters is what gets all the attention because it's so overwhelming. But it is kind of interesting that she consistently wins old voters and older voters against him. And so his, you know, for a guy his age to have such overwhelming support among young voters and less support as you go up the age ladder is pretty funny and pretty interesting.
Is there anything comparable on the Republican side when it comes to age?
No, the age gaps really aren't. I mean, it's interesting because the parties are sort of have different kinds of fault lines. I mean, one of the gaps on the Republican side has been education. You know, the Republican electorate is overwhelmingly white. So if you look at the difference between white college educated and white non-college, the non-college group has been typically a much better group for Donald Trump. Wisconsin was an exception to that. It was Donald Trump did better with blue-collar whites than he did with college whites, but he lost them both, and he lost college whites overwhelmingly, but he lost blue-collar whites to Ted Cruz, which hasn't been happening elsewhere, certainly not in the Midwest. And so that was just kind of a symptom of his problems. But education is a big fault line on the Republican side. You know, ideology a little bit. I mean, Ted Cruz is doing better with the most conservative voters, but, you know, Donald Trump kind of mixes up a lot of these categories because he gets some conservatives, but he also does well with moderates. And so in some ways the lines are cleaner on the Democratic side because you have Hillary doing much better with African-Americans and Bernie doing better with whites and Bernie doing better with independents and Hillary doing better with Democrats and Hillary doing better with women and Bernie doing better with men. You have the age gap. So you even have a kind of a religion gap in the sense that Bernie does better with secular voters in the party and Hillary does better with people that go to church. So I don't think that necessarily prevents the party from coming together behind a candidate in the end, because I don't think, even though this race will get and is getting more touchy as it goes on, just as the Clinton-Obama race did, I don't think it's the kind of schisms we're seeing on the Republican side.
Mm-hmm. Lisa in Milwaukee. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, I have a couple things. Well, I'm definitely a middle-aged woman who supports Bernie Sanders. My question is really about superdelegates, and I guess I don't understand so much. I understand a little bit. I suppose if the Republicans had superdelegates, they probably wouldn't be in exactly the position they're in. But as a Bernie Sanders supporter, I feel a little bit disenfranchised by the fact that we have these superdelegates that are taking a really close race and throwing it off what feels like a cliff to me.
So
is there some like code of ethics that they ought to follow, or, you know,
well,
like...
Yeah, there are, you know, it is a difference between the parties and has been for a while. And, I mean, the thing I would keep in mind about the superdelegates is that, you know, all the superdelegates that say they're for Hillary, you know, they're not bound to Hillary. I mean, they are free to change their mind anytime they want to. So their commitment is just who they're for, and it can change. They're not pledged. So it can, you know, if the race were to change dramatically, I'm not sure the superdelegates, the same superdelegates who are pretty lopsidedly for Hillary, if it was only their vote that stood between Bernie Sanders and the nomination, in other words, if they were changing a delegate majority from being a Bernie Sanders majority to being a Hillary majority just because of their preference, I think they'd be reluctant to have that kind of impact on the race. So it's a fluid thing. I don't think superdelegates want to be, you know, the decider if they're deciding against the will of the primary voters. But you're right. Psychologically, it does have an effect on the race, because when you see the delegate counts and you see Clinton with an edge among superdelegates, and even if you look at Wisconsin, where Bernie Sanders netted again, had a net gain of he won 48 and Clinton won 38 of the pledged delegates. That's a 10-point margin, but there are also 10 superdelegates in Wisconsin, and I believe 5 or 6 of the 10 have said publicly they're for Hillary, and the rest haven't said. So that just sort of cuts his pretty modest 10-point gain in half. If those numbers hold.
Mm-hmm. One more call for you, Craig. It's Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hello. I'm a Bernie Sanders voter, and I feel the burn towards the Bernie Sanders people because I woke up this morning and I have an incumbent alderman, an incumbent mayor, an incumbent county executive, and an incumbent Supreme Court justice who has a 10-year term. And all the Bernie Sanders people did is win a few more delegates than Hillary. And you can't just pull a lever and think you've changed the world. It's harder than that. And they feel all this injustice towards them. Well, wake up. Nobody has given them a civics lesson. You have to work every day for change. It just doesn't come that easily. And these, as you said, Kathleen, some 76,000 Bernie Sanders voters did not vote in the Supreme Court
That would have been Democratic voters, not just Bernie Sanders voters.
Yes. Well, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable how... And the same thing with the Trump people. They think they're supposed to pull a lever and the whole Republican Party is supposed to change. It doesn't work that way.
Thank you very much for your call, Tom. Craig.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. This isn't directly responsive to the caller, but in talking about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, there was some interesting data in the Marquette poll last week if you looked at the primary supporters of Bernie Sanders and asked them how they would vote in a general election involving Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, for example, or Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz, for example, you might expect 95 or 100% of them to say they would vote for Hillary Clinton, but that wasn't the case. It was more like 70%. So the rest of them were not out there supporting Donald Trump, but they were not expressing a preference for Hillary Clinton if she were the nominee. And so I think that just tells you that there are some frictions there, and there is going to have to be some rallying if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, some fence mending that she has to do. We can't say 100% that she's going to be the nominee, but I think this is part of the process that both parties go through when you have a long and competitive and sometimes tense nominating fight.
Well, and she's moving into really much more favorable territory with closed New York primary, closed Connecticut primary, closed Delaware primary.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it
Absolutely.
Is a big deal. Craig, thank you very much. I hope you get some sleep sometime.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Craig Gilbert, our guest, and Craig has a front page story and has been analyzing what's been going on in Wisconsin for a long time before the primary, and certainly has been all over the place the past few days analyzing what we were about to do and then what we did. Craig Gilbert, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief. He writes the Wisconsin Voter blog about politics and elections. We continue our analysis, but we have different guests with us and welcome more of your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Joining us now is Tim Murphy. Tim is senior reporter in the Mother Jones DC Bureau. Hello, Tim. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. And David Martosko is also with us. David is U.S. political editor for DailyMail.com, and he will be joining us just momentarily. Scotty's getting him on the phone right now, so we'll say hello to him. Wisconsin, so we had the national attention here, as you know, Tim, for a good solid week. Nobody else was having a primary or anything, so everybody was here. And I'm wondering if you think that we put too much importance on the state of Wisconsin, or did we do something big yesterday?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think what we saw over the last week was what happens when political experts and political writers and political campaigns only have one thing to talk about. So we had a lot of kind of minor turf wars over things that Susan Sarandon said that in an ordinary week we probably wouldn't pay attention to, and we just kind of needed to kill time. But I do think yesterday's results are pretty significant. Bernie Sanders, I think, has shown over the last couple of weeks, winning six of the last seven contests since March 22nd, that the campaign is not fading. It's basically right. As strong as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Last night's victory was a decisive victory. It might not be as decisive of a victory as he'd need, mathematically to kind of continue to keep pace if he wants to catch up with Hillary Clinton. But it shows that Sanders is still very much a legitimate candidate and that Clinton has a lot of work to do if she wants to catch up.
And why do you think that he is keeping pace here, that he's not fading?
I think, he really gets points for consistency. He has not really changed his message, and it's a message that's been working for him since New Hampshire, since Iowa, since Nevada, since, very early in the campaign. I think a lot of the younger voters who have given him so much of his support, I mean, you saw his, really large margins in certain parts of Madison. I think that resonates with them when you talk to those younger voters. Pretty much the first thing off the tip of their tongue is Bernie's consistency. It's the fact that Bernie has been out there, you know, on the front line for years and years and years. So I think, you know, and especially in a state where, you know, the demographics favor Sanders compared to Clinton, you know, exit polls, you know, showed that it was a pretty small African-American vote in Wisconsin, which Clinton won most of. So compared to a lot of other states, Wisconsin was sort of always going to be a strong state for him.
This pattern just keeps continuing. When you looked at 18 to 29-year-olds, 81% Sanders, those who are Democratic voters, and 18% for Hillary Clinton. The numbers are repeating themselves from caucus to caucus, primary to primary. They're astounding.
Yeah, they really are, and it's basically been like that way from the beginning. And a lot of these margins with younger voters with Sanders are different, you know, for white voters versus, say, African American voters. We saw in South Carolina, young black voters was the closest Bernie came to winning a core voting demographic down there, but he still didn't win. But that's been the story of his race, and it's, you know, it was the story of Barack Obama in 2008. You know, these are a very large number of Democratic voters in every single state, and if you can win margins like he has, you know, virtually every single state, you're going to be in contention through, you know, through June.
Mm-hmm. David is with us now on the line. Hi, David. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Let's go to the Republican side with you for just a moment here, where Ted Cruz won significantly, a little bit less than Bernie Sanders' margin, but not very much. They won about the same over Donald Trump, Sanders over Hillary Clinton. It was a very concerted effort on the part of elected officials among the base. They remain quite popular here in the state of Wisconsin among conservative talk show advocates here who really conducted an all-out campaign to get Cruz to a victory, and it was a big victory in the state. What does it mean? Does it move him forward? Do you see that this kind of movement is going to be replicated in contests ahead?
Well, it's hard to see how. I mean, remember, a lot of the contests coming are in the northeastern part of the country where Cruz is weakest. A poll just out a few hours ago from Monmouth University found that in New York, for instance, the next big contest, Ted Cruz is actually running in third place behind Trump.
Really?
Yeah. Donald Trump has 52% of the vote locked up in New York, and that's one of these winner-take-most states. I mean, he could conceivably pick up 80, 85 of New York's 95 delegates.
Mm-hmm.
Cruz really has a chance of being shut out completely because he's actually polling less than 20%, and that's the threshold to collect any delegates at all. A lot of the Northeast coming up, states like Rhode Island, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, these are not places that are very friendly politically to Southern evangelicals who, you know, wear their Jesus on their sleeve as they campaign. It's just not how it's done up there. And so I'm seeing this as sort of an observer who's on the campaign trail constantly and follows this stuff. I'm seeing this as a momentary blip, a slowing down of the Trump train, maybe a curve in the track before he hits another straightaway.
But a blip that is significant enough to keep this from being a contested convention?
It remains to be seen. I mean, the numbers are definitely going to be close. As you know, the magic number is 1,237 delegates that Trump will need to have on his side on the convention floor to win the nomination on the first vote. One thing that not a lot of folks have discussed, though, is the number of what we call unbound delegates who will come to Cleveland without an assigned horse in the race. About 10% of all the delegates will show up without any voting marching orders at all. So let's say Donald Trump doesn't reach 1237 in the primaries, and maybe the Wisconsin victory of Ted Cruz is one of the reasons why. Let's say maybe he gets to 1150, 1170, something like that. There are close to 240 unbound delegates coming to Cleveland in July, and if Trump peels off 70 or 80 of those, he's home. So there are all of these kind of off-the-board possibilities. It's sort of the equivalent of, let's say, the Democratic superdelegate. You know,
right.
Bernie Sanders sort of is actually almost running neck and neck with Hillary Clinton in terms of the earned delegate.
Mm-hmm.
And if these superdelegates weren't an issue, this would be a hotly contested race, and we'd be watching it as closely as we're watching the Republicans. And I think Bernie Sanders is running a campaign that hopes against hope that eventually some of those superdelegates will defect from Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these kind of unconventional angles. And among the Republicans, the next big thing people are going to talk about are these unbounded delegates.
Mm-hmm. Both of you don't live in Wisconsin, but you follow politics very closely. It strikes me as pretty amazing that this state went for Ted Cruz and for Bernie Sanders. Let's be a little philosophical here for a moment. When you hear that, if you weren't covering politics and you were just thinking, how would I describe the state of Wisconsin based on that kind of vote yesterday, Tim, what would you say about this state?
I'd say they're a little confused, but I think it makes a certain amount of sense if you look at something like the U.S. Senate race that's going on right now, that pits the Republican incumbent Ron Johnson, who was elected as part of a Tea Party wave in 2010, against the very liberal former Democratic Senator Russ Feingold, and those are in pretty good way of looking at two different, poles on the political spectrum. It's like a lot of states, like that, it's been able to support a very fervent conservative movement that has produced folks like, Scott Walker and Paul Ryan, while also supporting, a very fervent wing of the progressive movement that we've seen for about a century.
David, what do you think?
Well, I think it certainly the state looks schizophrenic from the outside, but the dynamics are a little different from my point of view. I talked to a lot of the voters standing in line at Trump events in the last week and asked them if they were undecided, what's in their mind. And about 20% of the undecided voters walking into a Donald Trump event said they weren't deciding between Trump and Cruz. They were deciding between Trump and Bernie Sanders.
Wow.
So there's a sense there that there's a sort of unwashed middle of independent thinkers in Wisconsin who aren't affiliated with anybody but are simply looking for somebody who's genuine, whose word sounds authentic. I think ultimately what happened is a lot of those folks deserted Donald Trump because of the controversies he got in with nuclear weapons and abortion and all that. So it's understandable. And if you remember also that sort of the conservative movement in Wisconsin is still sort of left over its organizing muscle from all the battles over unions that happened with Walker in recent years. So there was that infrastructure there, the calling list, the phone trees, the email groups, the listservs, all that for Governor Walker and his friends to leverage to push Cruz as the not Trump candidate. That's something they simply won't be able to replicate anywhere else moving forward. And, the southern states where they might have tried are all in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting looking at the breakdown of the numbers. Independent voters, those who voted on the Democratic side, 72% went to Bernie Sanders. On the Republican side, those who consider, and it's 27% of Democratic voters independent identified, 28% of Republican voters. The Republicans split 40-40 between Cruz and Trump. So it looks like many of those, many of those Democratic voters really are, and that doesn't portend well for Hillary, for Bernie Sanders carrying forward, because we got a lot of close primaries coming up, right?
I think that's accurate.
Go ahead, Dad. Tim, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, that's exactly right. He's benefited, so much throughout this process from, open primaries and independent voters, many of whom who haven't really been involved in, Democratic primaries, recently or ever. Getting involved, putting their support behind him. So in states where that's been an option, that's been hugely beneficial, New Hampshire being a great example of that.
Yeah. Well, let's go to phone calls. We have many of them for both of you. We're talking about what happened yesterday in Wisconsin when it comes to politics. Big, big primary. Tim Murphy, senior reporter in Mother Jones, D.C. Bureau, is with us. Also joining us is David Martasco. He's U.S. political editor for DailyMail.com. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, Kathleen Duncho, and we're on Twitter as well @KDuncho. Please send us Facebook comments because I kind of like Facebook and it's fun to read. We're really following politics closely now, so it's fun to read what your thoughts are about what happened yesterday. We'd like very much to hear from you. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network.
Tonight is a turning point. It is a rallying cry. It is a call from the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin to the people of America. We have a choice, a real choice. The national political terrain began to change 2 weeks ago.
All right, let's go with phone calls. Devin in Duluth, our next caller. Hi, Devin.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad.
Good.
So I'm a very ardent Bernie Sanders supporter. Actually, I used to be a Clinton supporter. Then I learned about how politics actually works and realized that Bernie Sanders has been on the right side of history since he started talking about things and people were listening. You can spend hours watching videos on YouTube about Bernie saying the right things all the time, never taking money to say those things, and it takes 5, 10, sometimes 20 years for Hillary Clinton to get on the right side of history. I think that's something that isn't talked about enough in media, and especially with National Public Radio in general. I've been kind of disappointed about the coverage on Bernie in particular and how much time has actually been given to Donald Trump. It's kind of disturbing in some regards, but I think Bernie Sanders represents the righteous vote, and Hillary Clinton represents the lesser of two evil votes. And I think, regardless, Democrats going to win. But if Hillary gets in, it's going to be a continuation of, you know, free trades with Panama and expanding private insurance companies and things of that nature.
All right, Devin, thank you very much for the call. What do you think, David? Has the media kind of ignored Bernie Sanders?
Well, some of the media have, but you have to understand that the Donald Trump phenomenon is really sui generis. There's been nothing like him in modern political history. As the political director for a mass market news organization, we serve something around 230 million readers a month. There is no degree of Trumpy goodness that we can give our readers that they won't devour. They just love to hear about the guy. Does Bernie Sanders get lost in the shuffle? Yeah, sure. But so did maybe a dozen Republicans in the process. We have dedicated reporters who are out there covering Democrats. I think recently they've probably written more stories about Bernie than about Hillary, only because Bernie is driving the emotional peak of the voters. People who read the news, who take the time to click on stuff and spend, you know, whether it's 5 minutes or an hour devouring the stuff, tend to gravitate toward characters and conflict. And it's a reporter's job to deliver enough context along with that to educate the readers along the way. But Bernie is a character, and he's stoking conflict with Hillary right now. And I think Hillary is trying to run from the conflict and portray herself as the safe option as much as possible, which just frankly makes her less interesting.
Well, we may not have seen many, if any, people like Donald Trump running for president, but Tim, we also haven't seen too many Democratic socialists running for president.
No, we haven't. and Sanders is historic in that respect, and he's long ago passed Eugene V. Debs in terms of the most votes ever received in a primary. And one thing that's interesting about Sanders and media coverage is that this has actually been a really long-standing issue for him. You know, he's written about it a lot in his books. He would hold, he participated in a conference with Abby Hoffman back in the 80s talking about the corporate-owned media. He's floated plans previously in terms of how to break up corporate-owned media so that it'll give, you know, more equitable coverage to candidates and that kind of thing. We hear a lot from conservatives criticizing media coverage in politics, and Sanders is really reprising maybe long-dormant liberal critique of the media, and that's something I think we're seeing a lot from him recently and from his supporters as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mike in Slinger. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Kathleen. Yeah, I just want to let everybody know that the superdelegates in Wisconsin are available. I have all 10 of their phone numbers and contacts, and I will be contacting them and recommending that they vote for Bernie Sanders instead of Hillary Clinton because he took the popular vote. And if they want to represent the state of Wisconsin, that's what they need to do. So it's out there. The information is out there, and you can call these people and you can talk to them and get the message across if you're a Bernie Sanders fan like I am.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Pat sends this email. Since 2012, Republican leaders have said they need to appeal more to minorities and women, also need to be known as a party that can work with others to accomplish goals. Now the two top presidential candidates seem to be the opposite, alienating women and minorities, especially Hispanics, and the other probably the member of Congress most known for non-compromising obstruction and government shutdowns. Was all the talk over the last 4 years just talk, or is the party falling apart? David.
Well, remember, all of those pledges tend to come from the party structure itself, the Republican National Committee. I don't remember hearing Donald Trump saying in the last year, gee, we've got to reach out to minorities and women. That hasn't been part of his platform, and I don't remember Ted Cruz ever saying that either. What you see there is reflected in that email, I think, is a clash between the party structure and the candidates who have emerged as leaders in the party. Believe me, the Republican National Committee does not want either Ted Cruz or Donald Trump to be their standard bearer. They're sitting there in their offices in Washington absolutely aghast that these two outsiders have sucked up all the oxygen in the political room, which is why they're licking their chops for a contested convention. The RNC mm-hmm. held a conference call late last week for reporters to explain all the rules because they're really hoping this happens. They want all of us to understand the rules and understand that they're trying to be honest brokers. But I think what they really want is to have such chaos and such a floor fight that, you know, like Deus Ex Machina, they parachute in a Paul Ryan or a Mitt Romney or somebody else who can carry messages in a more clean-cut, less sort of belligerent way and attract those voting blocks that have been running away from Republicans in droves.
Well, it's just hard to imagine the response if that should happen, isn't it? All the people who voted, oh my gosh, I can't imagine it.
Well, if you look at history, you can certainly imagine it. I mean, you know, Abe Lincoln didn't win the nomination on the first vote. He certainly arrived at delegates, but these things do happen over time, and I think the Republic, you know, we talk about the country becoming polarized. The Republican Party's definitely become polarized, between people who are comfortable the way the party has represented their interests in recent decades and people who have kind of had a political awakening and are saying, you know, and I've talked to literally hundreds of them on the campaign trail in like 20 states. They come to me and they say, gosh, I'm 54. I've never, ever voted before. But here's this Trump guy who says what I've been thinking, and I'm going to come out of the woodwork and support him. The party is freaked out over this, just shocked. And you're right. If they do parachute somebody else in, I think a lot of those disaffected Trump voters will go back to being non-combatants in the political battles, and they'll just sit on their hands and stay home. I think that's a recipe for disaster for the party.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely a split between the establishment and the upstarts.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's really necessarily fair to hold the upstarts responsible for promises the establishment made. It certainly doesn't work that way across the board.
Thanks for the call. Running out of time, Earl in Medford. Hi.
Could do more on following the money, learning from Watergate. Also about lobbyists like Grover Norquist who have people sign a pledge never to raise taxes. Are those still good things to be watching?
Tim?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the defining issues of the campaign this year in both the Democratic and the Republican primaries has been the issue of campaign finance. It's not always been, you know, dealt with and explicitly. You know, Donald Trump talks all the time about donors and this kind of shadowy world of Republican money men without ever explicitly saying that we need to repeal Citizens United or anything like that. Bernie Sanders obviously gets very explicit in calling for that. But money in politics has really taken on an importance as a campaign issue this time around that, well, I don't think we've really seen, at least in the last few decades.
Mm-hmm. And Elaine, we'll just get your comment from Colfax. Hi.
Hi, I'm an election worker, and it was a hopping yesterday. I mean, it was just busy, I mean, flat out running all day.
Oh.
And it was a surprise that Bernie Sanders just creamed Clinton in this rural township. And it was really sad, I thought, that Kloppenburg lost by just a few votes. And I think what I noticed as an election worker is people didn't vote in the Supreme Court election. They didn't know, other than the people that were following Cruz or Trump or whatever and going along with the other candidate for the Supreme Court. So I thought that was sad.
Yeah, there were a lot of people who didn't vote in that race is what numbers are showing. Thanks, Elaine. Good to know that things are hopping in Colfax on Election Day, and they were hopping all over the state, actually. We had a very large voter turnout, second only to New Hampshire in all the 30 states that have had caucuses or primaries. We thank our guests so much for being with us. It's a long season. We look forward to talking to you again, Tim and David. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting hour. Thanks to Craig Gilbert as well, and to Scotty Myers, who did on-air production for us here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return and talk about education with somebody who's only 20 and knows a whole lot about it.